Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Allison Gash, who's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. She's completing a manuscript entitled Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights, which will be published in 2014. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Allison Gash.
Thanks a lot.
So before we get into your article in the Washington Monthly, Allison, just to get an overview of what happened last week, obviously a very dramatic week in the Supreme Court in terms of the country moving forward on rights, but it seems to be sort of come down, if you can read the tea leaves in the Supreme Court, to an argument over states' rights versus gay rights, particularly with the Prop 8 case. Mm-hmm. What's your takeaway from both DOMA and the Prop 8 hearings?
You know, I think that the Supreme Court is going to be a little bit cautious about overturning all constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. I suspect what they'll probably do is either through a technicality or just by actually ruling on the merits. I think Prop 8 will probably end up being struck down in some fashion. And then my guess is for DOMA that they'll probably actually go ahead and strike that down if there isn't a standing issue. So, you know, I think reading the tea leaves, it's gonna look like what most people have been saying. They're gonna take the sort of moderate approach.
Well, there's an article in the New York Times over the weekend. Obviously, somebody had some sources on the court for the article, which talked about how the court decided to take up these gay rights issues and to take these cases. And what the article indicated was that the really arch-conservatives on the court, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, felt that they should take the case up early before the country turns. And the country, as you know, has changed dramatically, even since the Prop 8, in terms of polling. So that's an extremely cynical revelation, if that is the case, that they thought, that the conservatives on the court thought, we better take this up now while the country's still opposed to, or at least the constituency is. So what's your sense of that?
I mean, that intuitively makes sense because, you know, certainly it didn't seem from the hearings that Kennedy had any interest in taking up the case. And it certainly didn't seem like at least Ginsburg would be interested in going further than what the Ninth Circuit had done. So it didn't seem like there was any real incentive on the part of key members of the voting liberal bloc or swing voters to actually take the case. So it does make sense that it was the four conservatives that wanted to hear the case. And, you know, common sense tells you they wanted to hear the case in order to make sure that Prop 8 was upheld. But nevertheless, I still think there's probably, you know, there's probably enough of a critical mass or a majority on the court to either rule on these technicalities, which by default ends up striking down Prop 8, or to actually rule on the merits of Prop 8.
So, Allison Gash, let's turn to your article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. And it seems sort of counterintuitive in a way, because since gay marriage is so contentious, and as you know from this week in the Supreme Court, there were pro and con groups in front of the court screaming at each other. But you're suggesting that while this has been going on, that very quietly under the radar, adoption involving children of gay or gay parents adopting children, which you would think that the public would be even more skittish about that than they are about gay marriage, has proceeded apace and is, in fact, in many ways, fairly consolidated in law and fact. So that's odd, isn't it? I mean,
It is. And that's, you know, it was initially when I started on this project, I was looking for yet another instance of when civil rights litigation produced big backlash. And so I turned, you know, I was intending on writing a book about marriage and adoption and a whole host of other issues where we see this big sort of backlash effect. And it was much to my surprise in 2006 when I first started on this project that none of the 16 states that had some sort of initiative or some sort of legislation in motion actually produced any meaningful backlash. And so I started to dig and dig and dig, and so I found that, in fact, you know, there were a significant number of states, and, you know, at the time, 2006, far more states than had permitted marriage equality, far more cases involving co-parenting and adoption than it had involved marriage equality, and yet very little backlash, very little attention paid by conservatives. And so I started to interview some folks and found that there was a really interesting story about strategy there on the part of the advocates for same-sex parenting to keep this deliberately off the public agenda. And they've been able to do so in a really effective way, which I think has produced some benefits for the marriage debate. And that's sort of the, you know, the interesting conclusion to the story is that these have been mutually beneficial.
So is that to say then that the proponents of gay marriage have made a tactical error by having a public fight?
No, not at all. And you know what the article mentions and what the book spells out in greater detail is that there are some issues that are well suited for these below the radar tactics. Marriage was not one of them. And then it's actually, if you look back at the dawning of the modern movement for same-sex marriage, it really was intended to be a very sort of incremental state-by-state approach, one that wasn't supposed to ultimately produce this counter-movement. But, you know, the initial case was launched by individuals who were interested in marriage. It wasn't even launched by gay rights groups. But once it had been launched, they intended on trying to contain visibility. But it's hard to do that when you're talking about, talking about gay rights and discrimination and talking about a constitutional issue. But those were two things that, in the parenting front, parenting advocates could control. So they didn't have to make this about a gay rights issue. They made it about children's welfare. They didn't have to make it through a constitutional argument. They made it instead through family law and through technical precedent achieved through, you know, a multitude of court cases. So they were able to eliminate two of the more polarizing aspects of the gay marriage debate.
Again, I'm speaking with Alison Gash, who's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. She is completing a manuscript entitled Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights, which will be published in 2014. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. Of course, just to touch on this notion of tactics and of being below the radar, in many ways, not in many ways, but certainly in part, the passage of Prop 8 here in California happened, I think, because those that were opposing Prop 8 in their advertising weren't sure about what they were going to say. Their first group of ads that they put out, you didn't even know what they were about. They were so circumspect about even defending gay rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in many ways it helped Prop 8 pass, because one of the ways to overturn Prop 8, if the Supreme Court doesn't rule in its favor, would be to have another initiative here in the state of California that would be able to negate it. And the polls indicate that it would pass handily. And that's one of the big changes since 2008, is how much the public have become educated about this issue. So I think there's an example of not having your ducks in a row and having your arguments together and not going public with them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I think, you know, one of the lessons that we've learned over the past few years with the initiatives supporting same-sex marriage that have worked is that they actually took a page from these parenting advocates, and they focused on children's welfare. They focused on the benefits. They focused on things that, you know, a greater majority of the public could agree on. So instead of focusing it specifically on gay rights, they made a shift, you know, they shifted their tactics to match some of the arguments that opponents were making, right? So opponents have always been about children's welfare, procreation, child rearing, you know, to a degree they've talked about religion, but mostly it's been about these child-focused issues. And just recently the supporters of same-sex marriage have shifted their tactics as well, and that's worked. And so, you know, which isn't to say that that's the only reason why these recent initiatives have worked, but it is to say that, you know, it certainly seems to be a better strategy in these polarizing times.
Well, if Justice Kennedy is a swing vote, and if we're all trying to figure out what he's thinking in order to know what the ruling is going to be in June, the fact that Justice Kennedy focused on children quite a bit and talked about the 44,000 children of gay parents who were growing up feeling inadequate in the sense that their parents weren't legitimized by society or their marriages weren't mm-hmm. legitimized by society and that was a burden on the children, that was actually pretty encouraging. So I guess it's working.
That's right. And I think that's where the really interesting story about how these two issues, parenting and marriage, although they were, you know, decided in very separate spheres and decided using very different strategies, ultimately the strategy used by the parenting folks to keep it below the radar and build up this mass of support across the states has paid off for the marriage folks. Because now they can say, well, in California, it doesn't make any sense for there not to be marriage if marriage is specifically about child rearing and procreation, because in fact, gay parents are raising kids. So if it's true that we want to have marriage to preserve, you know, an optimal child rearing environment, it makes no sense that you would then have a state that has progressive laws with respect to gay parenting. And so you can make that argument. You can punch holes in the rationale and the reasoning of the opposition because of the existence of these states that allow same-sex couples to parent in the same ways that heterosexual couples do.
And in terms of the states we're talking about, Delaware, the District of Columbia, Illinois, Indiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Vermont, I guess, and also California, what are the states?
Allow second-parent adoption?
Yeah.
Let's see, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, D.C., Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Maine, Massachusetts, Nevada, New Hampshire, New York, New Jersey, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington, and then roughly six or seven other states where counties, individual counties, allow second-parent adoptions to occur. So places like Michigan, Maryland, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, New Mexico, Minnesota, West Virginia. So there's these things are happening both at the state level and then at the individual county level through individual family court justices.
But in terms of states, it looks like the entire South is opposed to parenting.
Yeah, I mean, except for these spots where you've got individual counties, right? So, so what a lot of gay couples do is they'll travel down to the county that allows it, and they'll get their second parent adoption there.
I see.
So there are opportunities.
So, and obviously the state of Utah, which is dominated by the Mormon Church, it's not happening there, right?
No. So Utah actually has a specific law that prohibits cohabiting non-marital couples from adopting and gives preference to married couples. So, yeah, they've got some fairly strict prohibitions.
So, Alison Gash, again, professor of political science at the University of Oregon and author of a forthcoming book, Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. So the idea of the legal precedent of the best interests of the child as a legal doctrine, that goes back to the mid-1800s. Mm-hmm. And that has basically been the core of this change that you're talking about that's happened under the radar.
That's right.
So now there was a period in the late 1970s when you had that country singer who promoted orange juice in Florida, Anita Bryant. She mm-hmm. came out with a thing called Save Our Children. I guess that didn't work. What happened in terms of the opposition here? Did they sort of get distracted from children and move on to adults getting married? I mean, you know, there's an asymmetry in this country between activists on the right and activists on the left. The activists on the right have an awful lot more energy and are more effective, even if their numbers are small, than those on the left. So I'm just curious to know.
Right. Well, so the Anita Bryant story is interesting. So she's responding to an anti-discrimination ordinance that was passed in her county. And so her concern wasn't necessarily about, adoption specifically, even though her campaign was about Save Our Children. What she was concerned about was this idea that gays and lesbians could now argue that they shouldn't be discriminated against in a range of things at the county level. And so she organized this organization called Save Our Children in order to frame her opposition to these anti-discrimination ordinances around children, right? She's a smart lady. She realized that if we focus on children's welfare, that's going to be the thing that amasses the most support across individuals. So she uses that as the frame to repeal that anti-discrimination measure and then ultimately takes it on the road, right? So other people copied some of her strategies. She went and supported other people's strategies. And ultimately, she's able to get a handful of repeals passed to undo some of the progress that gays and lesbians were able to make at the county level in the form of these ordinances. But what she didn't focus on, oddly, was adoption, right? She wasn't specific to the issue of adoption. But Florida, the Florida legislature, was moved by her arguments about children and nevertheless ended up passing a law saying that they were going to restrict adoptions to only heterosexual individuals, single or couples. So they were the only state to actually really take her literally and pass this ban. New Hampshire did later in the mid-1980s and then ended up repealing it 9 years later. So the Florida, that Florida ban was on the books for a long time. It ended up being overturned by a state court just a few years ago. But that was really the most draconian of the measures that were against gay parents. But the Bryant campaign, although it was framed in children, was about these anti-discrimination ordinances.
So it's a bit paradoxical, isn't it, or a bit ironic, I suppose, that what about at least half, if not more, of heterosexual marriages end up in divorce. Has that ever been brought forth, or is this issue of gay adoption so much below the radar that those issues aren't even brought up? It really is about the best interests of the child.
Yeah, so, you know, what's been really interesting about this tactic is that they haven't, you know, gay and lesbian advocates are not, they're not taking sort of a big policy stand in the sort of, you know, with the sort of frames that you're suggesting. What they're doing is they're saying, look, kids need stability, right? They're actually taking a page right out of conservative arguments. Kids need stability. You know, if you can get a two-parent family, even better. They deserve to have the ties to their parents that kids raised in heterosexual households have. And so they really take it specifically from the lens or through the lens of the kids that are being raised in these families, and they keep the issue of gay rights out of the rhetoric.
Well, I must say there's a charming show on television which is quite popular called Modern Family.
That's right.
With a gay couple who have the sassy young adopted Asian kid.
That's right.
That, I think, is, if that's a reflection of the reality, then we're in good shape here.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I actually, you know, there is an important role here to be played by popular media. And the fact that we end up seeing, you know, not just the token gay person here or there, but gay couples raising kids, you know, I think it really normalizes things for people, and it really, you know, it really hammers home for people that these are families just like anyone else's families that are being affected by these by these ridiculous restrictions.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alison Gash.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alison Gash. She's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. She's completing a manuscript entitled Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights, which will be published in 2014. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Bye for now.